is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I think one thing that is super important now, probably more than ever before, is your ability to connect with this young person. How can I connect with my staff? How can I connect with the athletic director? How can I connect with the community to make them feel like we're with them and we're building this together? How can I connect with our boosters to make them feel comfortable to invest even more money than they probably thought they wanted to? So I think the best in the business have figured that part out, and they continue to work at that and invest in that, because ultimately it's a people's business, it's a people game.
Brian Burton is the VP of Rising Coaches Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Alliance, the CEO of Uprise Athletic Group, and the All Access Network. He's also an ESPN college basketball analyst, along with being a longtime college basketball coach at various levels. Burton has spent time as an assistant coach with IUPUI, UTEP, Fresno State, Lamar, Abilene Christian, and Utah. Prior to that, he had 5 successful years coaching junior college programs at Richland College, Collin College, Paris Junior College, and Midland College. Burton has also worked in skill development under some of the best basketball trainers in the country for Nike and the Bryant Skills Academy, formerly owned by current Utah Jazz assistant Johnny Bryant. He began his career in grassroots basketball with the Dallas Hoop Dreams, an organization that he created with his brother Jason, who is currently the women's head coach at Texas A&M Commerce. He also coached with fellow grassroots organizations Dallas Mustangs and Dallas Showtime. Burton earned his bachelor's degree in American Studies in Business and Technology from UT Dallas in 2005, where he was a 2-year starter at point guard. Hey, Hoopheads, transform your training this May with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $1,000 off any commercial machine in the month of May. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Danny Gallagher, girls varsity head coach at Magnificat High School, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com. Have pen and paper handy as you listen to this episode, with Brian Burton. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by former college basketball coach, media member, rising coaches executive, Brian Burton. Brian, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to hopping on. It's an honor when you get to join some of the podcasts that you watch from afar, that you listen to. So cool to be able to be a part of this episode today.
We are glad to have you on. Excited to be able to dive in, learn more about all the different things that you've been able to do in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game that you remember.
Yeah, I think every kid kind of grows up playing soccer, right? Like my daughter's playing soccer now. It's like, oh yeah, this is where it all started. I was pretty into it. And fifth grade, I got introduced to basketball and never kicked a soccer ball competitively again. just kind of fell in love with it. And at that time, I was on like a little YMCA team or something like that. And yeah, that's where it started. My older brother maybe had started playing some too. My older brother's 3 years older. I ended up later playing college basketball my freshman year with him, playing against my younger brother. But yeah, it's kind of been a family game. Kind of funny. My mom didn't play. My dad claims he played some recreationally. He went to Michigan State, and he'll tell me about pickup games. He played with Magic Johnson. I'm like, hey, if Magic's on the other court, and you're on like the five courts over, it doesn't really count as playing with him. But
You're in the vicinity, man. Yeah, you're in the vicinity. That's what counts.
You can see him for sure. But started young, and then kind of always played up a little bit because I have an older brother, and you get those experiences playing a ton in the park, kind of differently than kids play now. Just I live with a neighborhood park at the end of the street, so whether there's old guys playing on Saturday mornings, like a day like tomorrow, and they're playing in the morning early, or it's playing at the rec or the YMCA. I just was kind of always a gym rat. And, played up with my older brother. Yeah, got a lot of good experience and moved around in high school. Went to school in North Houston area, kind of Conroe, Oak Ridge, Woodlands area. And then moved to Plano East and graduated there, and kind of got the best of both worlds, right? So, like, the first school I went to high school-wise was super fundamental. A jump catch every catch, box out every time, just very heavy emphasis on fundamentals. And then when I transferred to Plano East, believe it or not, at that time we had a tremendous amount of athletes. So it was completely different. So I was able to kind of combine the best of both worlds. And, I'd say PGC probably was a big part of my upbringing too, just – I only went once when it was Dick DiVincenzo, and Dina Evans actually was my coach, or excuse me, my teammate at the time. So she was just playing in the ABL. The WNBA wasn't even around yet. But long story short, that probably helped me in a different sense of just seeing the game beyond the game, and kind of that coach's part of me started to really develop from that exposure. So I coached my little brother's team when I think I was in ninth grade. He was in sixth. We lost our first game. And then we won every game since then. And my mom loves telling the story to this day, like all the dads being fascinated, like, how's he able to do that? And how's he able to keep these kids in check? And I don't know that I knew what I was doing, to be honest, but I think just the basketball player in you just, I don't know, you just kind of adjust and lead like you are your team. So, yeah, it's probably always been kind of natural. And then, play through college. And I'm sure we can dive into whatever parts you want to from there. But, yeah, played 4 years of college. Two at a Division II St. Edwards in Austin, one with my older brother. And then we just weren't winning. It wasn't very fun. I think my second year we lost 18 games straight. I think we were like 4-20-something. And we won our last game. Great feeling. And it was like going into the offseason, I just could tell. Nat coach wanted to keep getting better and didn't know if the players he had there were going to be what they needed to go forward. And I could have stayed and just – maybe had a backup role. But by the time you're a junior, as we see in the transfer portal now, you want to play. So I transferred to UT right. Dallas. I had a great experience, played for Terry Butterfield, who's still there now. And UT Dallas has kind of become a, Division III powerhouse in a lot of ways. My second year there was the first winning season in school history. I was the first senior to be a graduate. I'd have a senior day. We won our first championship that year as well, and they've won several since and been to Sweet 16s and Final Fours, or maybe not Final Fours, Sweet 16s and Elite Eights for sure, and they've had several All-Americans, and I've done a tremendous job. So, yeah, let's say from there I got into grassroots, and grassroots led me to junior college, and junior college led me to six different Division Ones, and quite a journey, 15 years in the game.
Let's talk a little bit about the playing experience as a college player, just the difference in experience from a Division II to a Division III. Anything that stands out to you? Obviously, there's a difference in winning and losing, which obviously impacts how you feel. But just think about the difference from a Division II, Division III school, what that was like for you.
Yeah, I would start by telling a quick story. I had a young man I was connected to, like, you know, now in this space, and we'll talk more about what I'm doing now, but you get connected in a lot of different spaces, from coaching space to player space to families to what you name it, media. So, young man at my alma mater, D3 All-American multiple times, transfers Division I, nobody really wants him, right? And then he ends up kind of, you know, we get some video out, he ends up kind of getting a little bit of traction. Next thing you know, he's got multiple offers, right? Well, he ends up going to a school, pretty high mid major, and starts, averages 12 a game, ends up proving he can play, right? We all know the Duncan Robinson story. Here's another one, and there's several others. Well, I think the biggest thing, you know, just for context, I want to say that, you know, the transfer portal is such a thing now. But the biggest thing is, I think, the difference in the level, number one, I think, is Division III is less size and less athleticism. So you don't have maybe necessarily a, you know, 6'8" four man and a, you know, 6'10" center, so to speak. You may have, but guys can play still. But there's not as much athleticism or IQ and skill, and probably smaller size. Obviously, the academic side, a lot of times the D3 is very good, but the basketball is good. You know, the basketball is still high quality basketball. Definitely feel like there's a ton of good players, similar to the one I just mentioned, along with guys like Duncan Robinson. I think Baylor had one of their centers not too long ago that I believe is now in the NBA with the Toronto Raptors. Gillespie, if I'm not mistaken, he was a Division III guy as well. So there's definitely players still there, and once you get experience, you feel like you can play with anybody. But my reason for transferring was to get more experience and have more playing time. And then Division II is kind of a sweet spot level, kind of an underrated level, similar to NAI in its own way, maybe a little higher level consistently, that is. But, yeah, you find Division I players that really just either have transferred down, or guys that maybe weren't looked at as Division I players coming out, but, you know, 2 years into it as they've had success. I don't think there's a ton of difference between Division II and Division I as far as there's different levels of Division II, like there is anything, you know, high, mid-major, low, mid, low, or high, mid, and low, kind of, so to speak. There's some Division IIs that could beat Division I's and do it every year. You see it in exhibition season. But it's filled with a lot of Division I players. There's definitely more size and more athleticism at that level, similar to the one. I just think there's a two next to the name for a lot of them and not a one. You may not have as much depth, but the top five, six players in a lot of Division II rosters are ultimately, you know, oftentimes either Division I transfers or Division I players themselves. So I would say that's probably the biggest difference.
We've talked to so many coaches at all levels, and they all talk about, number one, how good you have to be to play college basketball at any level. I don't care if it's Division I basketball, if it's Division III basketball, NAI, Division II, whatever. You just have to be a really good basketball player in order to do that. I'm not sure that every high school player and parent realizes how good you have to be in order to be a college basketball player. So that's one piece of it. And then I think the other thing that stands out about what you said, and this is another thing that we've talked to a lot of coaches about, is the need that if you're going to be really successful, if you're going to be a Division III coach, then you got to be recruiting scholarship players who may end up turning down offers to come play for you as a Division III coach if you really want to compete for a national championship. And it's the same
at Division II, if I'm going to be a really good Division II program, then I got to be recruiting those guys that potentially could play Division I and sell them on the fact that my school is going to be a better fit and maybe they get more playing time. Maybe they have an opportunity to have a bigger role. And I think those are things that when you look at the levels of college basketball, sometimes there's this misconception that I only can go Division I. That's what you see all the time. That's what people hear. That's what kids love to blast out on Twitter. But the reality is that if you get any opportunity to play college basketball, you can have a tremendous experience. And now, like you talked about with Duncan Robinson and the number of guys that come out of Division III that are able to go and play overseas and at least make a living for a couple years playing basketball, the opportunities are way greater than I think they ever were in the past. And so it's important. It's one of the messages that we've tried to get out is that if you get an opportunity to play college basketball, whatever level it is, you should be thankful for that opportunity and understand that you're in a really, really elite group, whether you're playing Division III or you're playing high major Division I. It really doesn't make that much difference in terms of you getting that opportunity to continue to play. Because for all of us, the ball eventually stops bouncing for everybody.
No, absolutely. I think you hit a lot of things on the head that it's harder to play in college basketball than just about anything you can do because the numbers, the sheer numbers of players that play, that have an opportunity to play at the college level, I believe it's 10% or less of high school players that play in college, period, let alone on a scholarship. So playing, you know, I think the biggest thing, it's almost like you play AAU or you play grassroots and, you know, given in most cases, a lot of teams that may not be a shoe circuit team can be the shoe circuit team or, you know, it's like the NCAA tournament. Anybody can beat anybody. It's, you know, basketball, the good thing about it, even when the Americans used to go play in the Olympics and lose the teams that they were less talented in, basketball is not a talent sport only. You know, it's definitely a team sport and so many team concepts and things that come into play that can have you lose on any given night, you know, even if you have more talent. So I think that's the beauty of college athletics, and it is very hard to get into, and it's so competitive, but those that get in it, you know, usually the ones that rise to the top are guys that are committed, and ultimately the things that it takes to be a winner are pretty much universal at all levels. The talent, you know, is only an addition to that. So, yeah, and I think shot making is kind of the great equalizer in basketball, right? If you can make shots, you see it again all the time in the NCAA tournament or whoever's playing whoever, if you can make shots, it definitely can take away a lot of things that you may not have as much talent, but when the ball goes in the hole more than the other team, then you have a great chance to win. So.
Especially in today's game, right? The way the game is played with three, certainly different from how it was played even 10 years ago. The game looks completely different. The volume of threes that are being taken and the amount of ball screens and just the way the game has evolved certainly has put a premium on shooting. There's no question about that. When you think about going to college as a college athlete, but also as a student, what was your thought process in terms of what you thought you wanted to do for a career when you got to college? Were you already thinking coaching was where you wanted to end up, or did you come into school with an idea that, hey, I want to be an accountant or I want to do something else? What was your thought process coming into school?
Yeah, good question. I didn't go into school. I probably thought more that coaching was more natural for me, probably because of my love and passion for the game. But I think I mentioned earlier, I played college ball my first year with my older brother, and he had played Division I for Billy Kennedy at Centenary and then transferred to Division II at St. Edward's. And so his biggest thing to me was just – and my brother, older brother is 6'8", so I don't know what happened on the size differential there. But I got the speed. I can't say that. But, want me to study kinesiology, for example, because that's what a lot of people do with coaching. Not always, but often. He just was like, you know, you can always fall back to that. It's something you naturally, you know, are invested in and can probably do if you want to, but just find something else that you're passionate about that you can study, and then you can always go back to that. So I really follow, you know, like most of us, if you have an older sibling, you follow their lead, and I thought he had some good point to it. So it's funny now, with all the things that I'm doing, my original major was actually communications. So who would have ever thought, right? Like, I had no idea. And I didn't have a particular thing within communications that I loved necessarily. I wasn't thinking like, oh, I want to do journalism, or, I mean, broadcasting sounded cool, but it's not something I thought twice about. You know, it was really just communication and kind of learning the nuances of it and all the different things that went in it, from interpersonal to mass to media to, you know, whatever. I just was interested in kind of that mass communication major at the time. Well, I went to school for 2 years at that school, and then when I transferred, I really wanted to stay in the same major because I really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, the school I transferred to, UT Dallas, was way academic, and I would have never been able to get out of high school. But much more of an engineering school. I did have good grades. I was like a 3.0 or so or more college student. So I was able to get in, but it wasn't I didn't end up studying something I thought I would do, but it was like a version of business and technology. I think it was American Studies in Business and Technology. I had one professor who kind of recruited me and said, hey, come to my degree. I think you'll like it, and take this class. And if you don't, and I liked it, so I stayed in it, and it helped me get through because I couldn't really find my niche within that school because of all the different type of majors I had. So I guess it has all worked out. I'm still doing communication, still doing business, and still working with technology, and I got to coach for 15 years, and I still do. So it all worked out.
It's funny how life works, right? Sometimes you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants, and things end up working out one way or another, and somehow you end up where you're supposed to be. And it sounds like that's what's happened for you. When you graduate, talk a little bit about some of your first experiences with coaching. I know you did some AAU stuff. You started an organization with your brother. Tell us a little bit about that and how that kind of got you jump started.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking. That's kind of, it's probably where some of even, you know, I did a lot of camps when I went back. So when I'm graduating from high school, it's funny, my high school coach and I, rest in peace. He was a great man. He was a challenging man to play for. He was a challenging man to understand because he loved sarcasm and to kind of play the mind games. He was an old school guy, and his way of complimenting you was to make fun of the person that you scored on. You know, he was never really going to give you anything straight. And so here it comes. I ended up graduating, and he asked me to work a camp, or I asked him if I could, and he allowed me to work a camp. And I wasn't supposed to have my own group. I was supposed to kind of be like the assistant with somebody, but they were sick that first day, and I got to have my own team. And he just kind of let me run from then on out. And then I coached the summer league and kind of every year when I came back. So coaching had already kind of started being a part of what I did. And after I graduated, I ended up coaching those young men that I had kind of gone back every summer to work with. And two of them were Division I players, and kind of knew one of them was for sure. He was a top 5 or 10 player in the state of Texas at the time. Really talented, hadn't played AAU yet, but created the AAU team for him and the other young man. The other young man is still playing professionally to this day. His name is Anthony Smith. He played at Liberty with actually Seth Curry for the 1 year Seth was there. He was a senior and the other best player on that team, but he's played played overseas. He's definitely was – he can look him up on some Ballers Life. He's got some pretty good highlights as far as his leaping ability, but he was kind of a blossoming kid and kind of just saw his upside and wanted to make a team and create it. And so anything – if you know anything about me and my brother, my younger brother is by far the most competitive of all of us, probably because he's the youngest of three, right? So
yeah, that's usually how it works.
It's only natural, right? So he – always trying to prove he belonged, so on and so forth. Well, I kind of knew once I started an AAU organization that, well, I better make a team for him, because what happened was we had two teams, and he was kind of trying to coach the second team, and it wasn't his team. So I'm like, after the first weekend, I'm like, all right, I got to get this guy a team. And there's a high school coach in Dallas, Joe Duffield, who's now the head coach at Lake Highlands, has a tremendous team and program and has a really talented, I think he's got one of the number one players in the country in 2023, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, he had a young team at the time. I think he was at maybe Bryan Adams, and he wanted his guys to play in the summer. So we just kind of created a new team so my brother could have his own team. And then the next year, actually created it and passed it over to him where he could coach and run the entire organization and set it up with a gentleman out of Dallas that kind of had a 501c3, and it allowed him to get paid for practice, paid for games. So trying to set my brother up much better than doing it for free and doing the grind like most of us do. And he did well with it. It's pretty cool how it worked out. It kind of led to his college career. He had some kids on his team that he ended up, one, he ended up signing, or not signing, but committing, I guess you call it, when it's Division III. He played at Austin College. This young man is the Austin College all-time leading scorer. Well, he signed him, but he coached him. And almost he coached him when he was in AAU, and then when he hurt himself his junior year with the knee surgery, so he couldn't play, and they didn't have an assistant spot. So he just volunteered and was an assistant. Next thing you know, he signs the all-time leading scorer. He signs that whole class. And, yeah, those guys had a good run at Austin College. So it's cool to see how, you know, the foundation of that has led to kind of what's going on now. And ironically, he's now a Division I head coach. And not knowing it when I met my wife, but she had started a volleyball club. And her sister got started coaching in her volleyball club. And now she just took a Division I head volleyball job.
Wow, so that's wild.
Kind of ironic how that works. But ball is life in this family for sure.
How's the first – take us through your JUCO experience. How does that come to pass? I know you went through a couple different positions there for about 4 or 5 years. Tell us a little bit about your experience at JUCO.
Yeah, I think JUCO is – you know, I'll say this first. I think JUCO is one of the best levels to learn – coaching, learn basketball, learn the business of basketball. I was with we interviewed Chris Crutchfield at the Final Four, just got the head job at Omaha, and he talked about, you know, every coach should have a chance to coach in JUCO, and it's almost like the should be a prerequisite in some ways because you just learn so much. And it was a prerequisite in our marriage. I'll be fully full disclosure. My wife coached 2 years at JUCO, so she had the prerequisite requirements, so we're good. She coached JUCO volleyball. So I started – so from AAU, I started that program, and then I ended up – the hardest recruit I ever signed in my life was my cousin, Michael Bradshaw, who was almost like a brother to me, little brother. He's in between my age and my younger brother, and he was playing – he signed out of high school at Akron to play basketball and football, but it was a football scholarship. So he ended up kind of not loving football as much and redshirted and still wanted to play basketball. It didn't work out. So he left and went junior college in Saginaw, Michigan, and then transferred. I finally got him. He used to tell me every day he's coming. I never believed him. So he taught me how to keep recruiting people around him, how to keep staying resilient and persistent. And until he got off the plane, I wasn't thinking he was coming, but he got off the plane and we ended up finishing third in nation that year at Richland Junior College. That was where I started D3. I was still going to school to finish at UT Dallas. And I just loved it. I had a choice between working at a private high school or doing that. And the private high school actually paid. And at the time, the JUCO may not have paid. And I kind of was going to the high school at first and took that, accepted it verbally, kind of went to the first day. And I was like, I need to go back to the JUCO. This is too, you know, just – you get spoiled with a level. So love Division III JUCO for that 1 year. And then Coach Sagona, Jim Sagona, recruited me out of high school. I went to Plano East. Collin County's in Plano. And went to him and just said, hey, would love to, you know, have an opportunity if you ever have any openings. He had an opening. So then my first full-time job out of college, graduating, was at Collin. And I got to be the dorm apartment person and learn that navigation and I want to say the job was like $10,000 in an apartment. So you felt like – I felt like just the fact that I went from a – so I ended up getting paid originally a $3,000 stipend. But to get $10,000 and have this apartment, I felt like I was rich. You know,
yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Like $1,000 a month and
yep.
Felt like I was doing something. And so I did that in AU and had a lot of opportunities, to be honest. People probably would think I was crazy if they knew the amount of list of – schools and opportunities that I turned down, and even some of the head coaches that are now, you know, at major universities. They saw more in me than I was probably in myself, and I probably wasn't ready to jump into the college game all the way yet. I was still in my comfort zone. I just loved helping kids to figure it out. I loved being a little bit closer to home. At some point, I needed to make more money, but I did it really enjoy it because it gave me a lot of hands-on. So my last year at Collin, we ended up being 12 in the country. I took a job at Paris Junior College. just because I knew Collin County was different. It was kind of an academic recruit qualifiers, and it's like my first recruit I ever signed is now a Division I head coach as well, same school as my brother, Texas A&M Commerce, Coach Jerry Von Rosenberg. So he was the first kid I ever signed. He was had Division I offers, kind of wanted to get more and just get a better look, so he came for 1 year. So we created a lot of one-year academic guys, kind of more, almost like more of a prep school model, if you will. It's too hard academically to kind of make it. So I knew it wasn't real college basketball in the sense of how the day-to-day was run. Tagona gave us a lot of hands-on. I got to do conditioning and off-season and strength and conditioning and academics and recruiting. He let me do a ton. But I knew I needed to make the next step to a higher level place, junior college wise, day in and day out, and probably a place that I had to babysit more and have more challenging kids. So I went to Paris with Ross Hodge, who's now the associate head coach at North Texas. And boy, was I in for it. I knew I was in for it, but I was. It was definitely, to this day, the hardest job I've ever had. And not because of anything he did, but it's only two of us and a manager, and we just had a talent. We were sixth in the country, I think, is the highest we got. But we just had – we had a lot of it. And it was a small college town – I mean, a small town, and everything you did was magnified. We had to do some addition by subtraction, get rid of an All-American. And it was some adventures, but I definitely learned study hall. It was nonstop. From the day the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, it's just always something. And it definitely helped me understand what it took to kind of get to the next level. And like some people think that the academic part goes away when you go to Division I, but unless you're at certain places, it doesn't. It really gives you a training ground to help figure things out, to help your guys that need it or guys that need summer school. And you're just navigating, and you find out you can wear different hats and you can sign players that maybe someone else isn't willing to sign because they don't know how to figure out their academics. So it definitely gives you a lot of advantages. And like I said, just builds a different kind of resolve. And the cool part about college basketball too is JUCO guys always gravitate to and respect other JUCO guys. It's like if you're recruiting a JUCO player and you've been in JUCO, it's like the JUCO coach is more willing to help you because you understand a JUCO guy and what it takes. So I think there's a cool bond that happens with guys that have been in junior college, and more successful Division I head coaches than people realize start a career in college.
I think it's a place where a lot of people aren't aware of. When you think about growing up as a high school player, you're a college player, unless you've been at that level as a player, I think there are a lot of people that aren't even aware of what junior college basketball is and what those opportunities are, both for players and for coaches. And I think there's a lot of education that when people find out about it and they learn more about it, they can see where, as you said, the potential benefit for A, someone who's a young coach starting your career, and B, the opportunity for players to come in and perform academically, perform on the basketball court, and then parlay that into another opportunity is just, I think, something that is a little bit underrated. And if you can get that out there in front of people and help them to understand just what JUCO is all about, like what you're talking about, I think people would see that there's a tremendous amount of benefit there for both players and coaches.
Yeah, probably my favorite time coaching, honest, in a lot of ways. My closest relationships with players from that time, the players' closest relationships with other players, you just have a different bond. Because essentially, people hear this kind of thing all the time, but in junior college, you are getting it out the mud. Like, you're not – there's no luxury in junior college. You are – the cafeteria is not the same. The meal plan is not the same. The amenities aren't the same. The facilities aren't the same. But the motivation and the drive and the determination to just be successful, I think that's the part. It's like no politics. There's no agendas other than, like, everybody's in there trying to figure out how to make it and how to make their dream come true. And I think that's the part that, you know, you get a lot of hungry dogs. And even when you're playing against other teams, the competitive nature of those games is like you never know when that one game or that one moment may be the game for you to end up kind of having a breakout to get to the next level. So I think it's one of the funnest levels, and definitely a level that I do my best to try to promote more of, because people just don't realize kind of the, what really goes on at level. There's a lot of misconceptions. And even now with, you know, Last Chance U does help in some ways, but in other ways it doesn't help. It does help because it's cool and it's on television and people are celebrating, but it doesn't give the full picture necessarily either because, you know, it's sensationalized television too.
What's one or two lessons when you think back to those years in JUCO that you've taken with you throughout your career?
Good question. I would say one of them, and I love this from my guy Ross Hodge. He was a big time Cowboys fan, still is, and he used to talk about the book. You know, I think it was one of those books talking about the old school Cowboys when they used to in their heyday. And I think one thing he took away from it, and he used to talk about regularly, was like, "Hey, all this other stuff, we just got to get them to the game, and then go figure out how to win." So sometimes instead of focusing on all the stuff that happens on the court and all the distractions, it's like there are some teams that can weather the storm and still figure out how to go, because no one knows what goes on behind the scenes. Let's be honest. Whether it's Baylor winning a national championship, whoever it may be, right? I'm drawing a blank on who even won this year. Kansas. Nobody knows what challenges Bill Self had with Remy Martin or whoever behind the scenes, right? Nobody knows. It's just get to the games, figure out how to get these guys playing their best ball, and it's kind of the cure-all in a sense. So I think sometimes even in life, I think we can focus on these little negative things or these little things that just don't go right, and we let something maybe ruin our day. But in the end, it's almost like maybe not get to the game, but keep the bigger picture in mind. As long as you can still get to that win, you're always going to have adversity and challenges and things that go against you. So I think that year kind of taught that, because it was one of the best competitive teams I've ever been on playing for. We won a championship, a co-championship. We were lost in double overtime to go to national tournament. Just one of those teams that was really good when the ball went up, and they figured out how to put it together when the lights came on. So I think that's probably one of them. It's just like, don't sweat the challenge or the adversity, or don't get bogged down with that. Just stay focused on your mission, which is ultimately to win and whatever you're doing. And I think that's probably a big one. And the other one, I think, is probably just a little bit of, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. You know, junior college, again, I was at Collin County, which had a lot of guys who were academically sound and higher character, and not always, but most of the time that's who coach wanted to recruit. Well, at the other two stops, Paris and Midland, you know, Paris, we had a guy who played in the NBA, Jonathan Simmons, played for the Spurs and played for Orlando Magic. You know, so I recruited and signed and convinced the head coach that we needed to take, and we ended up taking him. But, you know, someone's in a place in his life. That young man had some things off the court that people were kind of judging him on. He had some things on the court. He had never won. But then, you know, putting him in the right culture, putting the right season, and putting the right accountability and love and tough love and teaching and everything else, and the dude ends up making it to the NBA. So it's just one of those things where that's one story, but another story may be, you know, about somebody else who – academically just wasn't very good, had to go to junior college, struggle, but next thing you know, that light bulb kind of comes on, and you know, now they're making six figures in a corporate job. So I think that's probably the other part, is just not judging a book by its cover, and just investing and believing in the best in people, because sometimes the guys that do go to junior college are kind of the forgot about guys, the counted out. He won't make it because of his behavior. He won't make it because of his academics. He won't make it because he's not good enough. And just seeing a lot of those guys, again, even going back to Collin County, we had guys that I can think of a kid, Drew Allen, who wasn't supposed to be, you know, he's a 6'2½ white kid that could shoot and wasn't supposed to be a Division I player, and ends up having two good years for us, walks on at Southern Utah, then becomes a scholarship player, becomes a captain, then later on goes back to be a coach there. So just there's a ton of stories like that, that where you feel like guys are counted out and you can't judge a book by its cover or what you hear. And, you know, that's where the coaching and sometimes the transformation can happen.
Having an impact, right? That's something that, look, you can look at it and you can say, here's a kid and was going maybe in a place where he wasn't going to get those opportunities. Now all of a sudden he gets an opportunity, coaching staff works with him. He parlays that into another, and boom, soon he's playing Division I basketball, and then he's coming back and being a coach. And that kind of impact that you can have both in the kid's life and on the floor is really what it's all about. And I think that's when you start talking about the stories that you've told so far to this point, you're talking about success stories of kids that you as a coach and your coaching staffs that you've been a part of have been able to make a positive impact on kids at all different levels.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
You had an opportunity after you are in the JUCO for 5 years. You get an opportunity at Utah. How does that come to pass? Where does that opportunity come across your desk?
Yeah, trying to get an assistant job. It's like a lot of things happen in probably a little bit similar to marriage, and I'm kind of joking, but you know, you shoot your shot high and then it's like you get rejected, but then somehow it just works out where you end up where you're supposed to be. So I actually shot my shot in marriage high and it worked out, you know, with my wife. So I definitely outkicked my covers, as they say, and did my best recruiting job. But I was trying to get on with Jim Boylan, who was just was recently the coach of the Chicago Bulls before Billy Donovan, and was trying to become his assistant because they said he wanted to recruit Texas. And I had kind of got that word, and I was pretty naive. I just, you know, you're just going after it, and I was going after it so blindly but so aggressively. He was impressed and kind of offered me, I think it was like a player development position that year. And I ended up not doing it. But then the following year, I was like, you know what? This junior college thing worked out. You know, it was a good experience, but I definitely want to experience that level. So I got to a point where I just knew I just wanted to go. And I actually turned down a Division I assistant job, which is kind of ironic too, because later my brother got the same job at Texas State with Doug Davalos. So that's kind of the irony too of how God works. But I was, I turned down an assistant job. I kind of felt like for me, you know, I'm one of those people, so much stuff happens for me from feel. I wanted to be able to see what the highest level was like and be in that kind of high level organization with, you know, Jim Boylan. If you know anything about his resume, worked for Rudy Tomjanovich, won championships with the Rockets, started in the video room, kind of like Spoelstra, and just kind of worked his way. Then was at Michigan State with Izzo, then became the head coach of Utah. So I'm like, this guy's pedigree is, you know, impeccable. So why not work for somebody where you can kind of learn it and see it first before just kind of jumping into that seat? So I wanted to have that familiarity again, playing Division II, Division III. Didn't win in college until my last year. So I think that's the hard part too, is like you haven't been around winning. I just kind of wanted to see it at the highest level. So anyway, I chose to kind of take a assistant player development type role where you're just in the organization. It's a lower level job, but you're just in the organization figuring it out. And yeah, I got to see it and I got to figure it out. So another, probably one of the most challenging years personally, first time that far away from home. I'm in Utah, I'm from Texas. And just kind of seeing the business side of how college basketball really works was good for me. And I actually ended up getting out of it for a year after that and doing some skill development stuff. I got worked with some of these Nike Elite Skills camps. Got to be one of those guys. Had like a 24-hour fitness contract. I think I was the youngest person in the country with a 24-hour fitness training contract, kind of this partnership. You get to use their facilities. And then I just kind of realized, like, I'm probably more qualified and God has probably called me to more than just teaching a kid how to use his arm bar when he dribbles, you know?
Yep,
no offense to that, but there's a lot of people that can teach that. I think there was a a population of young people that I think God gave me a gift to connect to. And he was like, you know, I made you for more than just this. I know you're probably uneasy about the business side of college basketball, but, you know, I've equipped you to do more. So I actually got on there. From there, went to Abilene Christian, got hired by Grant McCaslin, who's the head coach at North Texas now. He was coming from Midwestern State. Abilene Christian was still a D2 at the time, but had just made the plans to go Division I. And, yeah, so I got on with him and kind of hit the ground running for about 3 months. And the next thing you know, he goes to Baylor, and then Joe Golden gets the Abilene Christian job. And my D2 career was for 2 years, and then I had 1 year transition Division I. And Joe Golden, Brett Tanner, myself, Patrice Days, all the people that were in the trenches that year are definitely bonded for life from going through that tough experience. And then for those guys to go on and do what they've done and build ACU into a place that not only goes to the tournament, but it's getting tournament wins against Texas. And so anyway, I got to experience that first Division I ride, and then went from there to Lamar to Fresno State, Fresno State to UTEP, UTEP to IUPUI, and like I said, 6 different Division I's, and got to see a little bit of everything.
What do you think after all of your experiences? I'm going to ask you, this is a two-part question.
Yeah,
so what do you think makes for a good assistant coach when you think about the different people that you've worked with, that you've worked for? What do you think are a couple of the most important traits for a good assistant coach? And then we'll circle back and talk about what are some of the traits that you think make a good head coach, or maybe a good head coach to work for as an assistant. So let's start with the assistant piece. What are some key characteristics or traits of an assistant coach that you think help to make someone successful?
Yeah, that's a really good one. Let's just say in 3. So I think having that anticipation and taking initiative, I think that's a huge one, to kind of be able to see problems before they come, to be able to have a feel for what's needed before it's asked, which is, you know, kind of one of those gray areas, right? It's not something that's a hard skill, probably more of a soft skill, I guess they would call it, but it's a feel thing without a doubt, and something that's so important to be able to have, because there really a lot of the job is being able to get ahead of it, whether that's with recruiting, you know, seeing a problem before it happens, whether that's, you know, kind of anticipating something that may happen with your own program. You're on a winning streak, you're anticipating your guys maybe feeling a little bit good about themselves. Just being able to kind of have a feel for that stuff is so big, I think. So just being able to be a step ahead, you know, be a step ahead of the head coach so you can make his job easier, be a step ahead with the other assistants to help them be their best selves and try to, prevent. It's really about preventive maintenance, right? You don't want to get in that crisis management mode. You hear people talk about that
right.
a lot, right?
Being proactive,
man,
right?
Being proactive. And I should have said that's essentially the word I was looking for. Proactive, anticipating problems, taking initiative. So that would be one. Similar to that, problem solving. I mean, just being able to understand, okay, problems are going to happen more often than not. And probably 20% of the game is – I mean, 20% of the job, maybe 15, is actual basketball. Everything else is everything else, right? From academics,
absolutely,
to community service, to scheduling, to fundraising, to you name it. There's so many other elements. Recruiting is a huge one, obviously. The brand of the program, all of these things are so important. So problem solving is huge, I think, in being a really good assistant coach, because there's just going to be so many of them, right? This is probably a trickier one to think about, the third one, but I almost want to say, you know, just the ability, and this is, you know, kind of simple but yet important, just the ability to be able to get things done. You know, I think that probably goes into a lot of different waves. There's a lot of guys that are nice guys and are on staffs and you know, but it's a hard thing because it's kind of that cliche, like, you know, you have to be able to get things done, but you do, you know, it's ultimately comes down to winning and losing. And you want to be able to do things the right way and have a high character, but you also want to be able, and you also want to be able to get things done. So I think, you know, when we're talking about, like, people talk about guys that, you know, you get those calls a lot. Hey, who's the next guy up, or who's the next guy we should look at, or who should we, you know, guys that have an ability to not just problem solve and not just be proactive, but also just have an ability to execute. I guess that's a better way to put it, in the sense of whatever that may be, whether it's scheduling, whether it's, again, academics. If somebody's in charge of academics, but the academics isn't very good, then they may not be very good as an assistant. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Hey, absolutely.
This is your role. So I think that's the part where, I guess, kind of being a star in your role, whether it's not the role you want or not, you have to be able to really be able to get things done, you know, at a high level and be able to execute and make things happen. So I think that's kind of an underrated one, because I think so many people kind of get into just other stuff, like perceptions and this guy's this and this. But it's like, sometimes it's like, well, who's actually really good at getting something done, or has the aptitude to continue to learn to be able to get something done? If you want to do something new, maybe you're hiring a guy he hasn't ever recruited, but he's really excelled in his role as the ops or whatever, and you see that he kind of has that growth mindset and that initiative and that motor, which is probably another one, because you definitely have to have a motor in this thing. So anyway, there's a lot of them, but that's probably the main three. And then head coach wise, man, I think the ability to know who you are is probably one of the biggest ones, to be know who you are and be secure in it. And it may be the hardest one of all of them. And a lot of guys struggle with that, you know, knowing what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. And just because you have to hire somebody else and another strength, to still be able to be secure in yourself to lead and kind of have that self-awareness. So I'd say self-awareness would be one. Ability to communicate has to be up there, because this, you have to be able to communicate to everybody, to your boosters, to your administration, to and communicate through the tough stuff, you know, right? Like, not just the easy stuff, like, oh, we won three games, like, get on a press conference and you can be great. But when you lose three games, how do you handle that? And when you lose, have a losing season, you know? I think those two, communication, self-awareness, and, you know, probably a little bit of a about the self-awareness is like delegations like that. But I'd almost just say, you know, how does that person handle adversity? You know, you see a lot of coaches that are great when things are good and you're winning and you're having great seasons. But I think when you have adversity, what kind of character comes out then? What, how do you treat your staff then? How do you continue to lead your staff then? I think that part is huge, and that has so much to do with your culture, because your players will feed off of that communication. That self-awareness allows you to be great with them. And then how you handle adversity, you see so many times where, you know, obviously players are getting in the portal regardless, but you just see so many times where guys may lose their cool a little bit more when things don't go their way or when things don't happen the way they'd like. And yeah, you just like, you'd like to see, I think the best of the best are able to, yeah, you can still push guys, you can still have intensity. That's not, I think people kind of get those things confused, but you still have to have enough control when adversity happens where you can still lead and kind of rise above it and lead your troops through that. So I'd say probably those three.
I love that self-evaluation piece. That's something, Brian, that we've talked about with a lot of different coaches, in terms of being able to look at yourself, as you said, figure out what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, and then being able to evaluate both in good times and in bad times and understand where you are. And I think that's something that it's not always easy to do, right? It's not always easy to look in the mirror and figure out, hey, what am I doing that needs to be done differently so that we can get a different result? Or what am I doing well that we need to continue, and how can we continue to grow if we already have a successful program, we're already having a great season, how can we continue to get better and improve? And I think that that ability to look at yourself and look in the mirror, and I think this applies in all walks of life, but I think in coaching, it's especially important when you're trying to deal with not only yourself, but you're also dealing with other people when it comes to your staff, your players, the surrounding people that are part of, if you're talking about college athletics, you're talking about the whole college community, your AD, your school president, all these different pieces right. that go into having success. You have to be able to really look at, hey, what are we doing? What am I doing as the head coach that will enable me to be able to have a successful program? And I think that, to me, that's kind of like the overarching umbrella, because everything else kind of falls 100%. Underneath yep. that. So you're talking about, hey, communication, I'm evaluating. What kind of a communicator am I? Am I a guy who, when things aren't going well, do I shut it down? Do I start pouting? Do I treat the players differently? How do I react with the media? Right. Those are all 100%. Things. Yeah, exactly. Those are all things that I think are really important. And they all, when you start thinking about looking at yourself, you're looking at those different pillars that make you successful, whether that is communication, whether that is the ability to have an impact in such a way that you're doing it. And you're kind of, as you said, you're aware of who you are, you know what you stand for, and you're going to stand for those things through good times and in bad. And that's sometimes really hard to do. We've talked to a lot of coaches that have told us, yeah, they've told us, like, look, especially as a young coach or in your first head coaching job, it's sometimes you're still trying to kind of figure out, like, who am I? Because you may have worked for 4, 5, 6 different head coaches in your career before you get an opportunity to be a head coach. And obviously, you're pulling things from all those different coaches, and you're trying to figure out, well, what's my philosophy? What do I truly believe in? What are the things that I need to have in place? And I think sometimes it takes a little while for coaches to feel secure enough in their own skin to say, okay, things aren't going perfectly the way we want, but I still believe in what we're doing. Whereas sometimes if you're a little less experienced, it can be easy to just, okay, I thought we were going to do this, and now, oh, that's not working. Let's throw that out and try something else. It takes a little while to kind of get that feel for what you truly stand for as a coach.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I think there's so many different things pulling at you. It's almost like if you had a, and I don't know if you have kids or not, I think you do. So it's almost like if you had an audience to watch your parenting every day when you first had a parent, it's like, wait a minute, he shouldn't be doing that. He shouldn't be doing this. And, you know, it may not be the best example, but it's the best example I can give. Or in a marriage, it's like all of a sudden somebody has a camera inside your home to watch you and how you're handling. It's like, well, I've grown so much, and I've only been married for almost 5 years now. In June, it'll be 5. So, I mean, I've learned a ton. And how I was in the first couple of years, I probably wouldn't want people to know some of the things that I was reacting to or may have even not handled the best way. And same with parenting, you know, I think those are the things. But coaching, you have an audience. So when you have an audience for what you're doing and there's a win and loss, you know, in our marriage, there's no record from our first year, right? We would count it as a win because we made it through and we didn't kill each other. You know, that's a win.
You're not in the marriage portal.
So we stayed out of the portal, we keep moving. So it counts as a win. But in coaching, you have this win-loss record, you know, and you have everyone sees what recruit you get. And it's really a celebrity culture. People don't really talk about it as that, but I mean, you're a public figure, you know, and everything you do is public knowledge. When you hire a coach, when you lose a game, when you win a game, when you get a promotion, when you sign a good player, when the kid goes in the portal, everybody knows everything that's happening. So it does create, when you first get into a new seat, I always talk about this in development, you know, first in development, you have to get out of your comfort zone, then you get comfortable, and then you can get confident. Well, you're out of your comfort zone if you're a head coach and you've never done it before, or if you're a head coach and you hadn't been a Division I head coach, or even if you hadn't been a head coach at that particular place, because there's new eyes on you and you're in a new place and new expectations. So I think all those different things pulling at head coaches does make it hard to be as secure you want and do things in the ways that you want, and you're making mistakes in front of people, and ultimately you feel judged, you know what I mean? No matter what. So it takes being able to get through some of those first years and not worry about what everybody else thinks and have some success and have some failure in order to probably get rooted in it. And I think going back to those head and assistant coach qualities, I think one thing that is super important now, probably more than ever before, is your ability to connect and your connection. So as a head coach or as an assistant, you know, your connection to your staff mates that you're working with, your connection to players, because obviously, again, we brought up the portal a couple of times, but it's not even just about players leaving or staying. It's just about, in order to get the best out of them, it does take something beyond just being able to communicate and being able to figure out, how can I connect with this young person? How can I connect with my staff? How can I connect with the athletic director? How can I connect with the community to make them feel like we're with them and we're building this together? How can I connect with our boosters to make them feel comfortable to invest even more money than they probably thought they wanted to? So I think that part is kind of an X factor thing, right? It's like you have these other things that are the kind of foundational things that are super important too. But, you know, your ability to connect, I think the best in the business have figured that part out, and they continue to work at that and invest in that, because ultimately it's a people's business, it's a people game. And if you can't connect, then it makes it really hard for you to get things done the way you want to. Now, before, it used to be like, do it because I said to do it and my position says I'm important. Right. Now it's really more so based on how they feel like their connection is with you more times than not.
What's been the key for you in your career as far as building that connectedness with players? What have you been able to do? How do you go about, or in your mind, what do you think about when you think about connecting with players? What does that look like for you as an assistant coach?
Yeah, good question. I think some of it, honestly, as much as I'd like to say this, that, and I think some of it is natural. You know, I think I'm naturally a person who wants to see others do well. I think the servant leadership in me comes more natural. And some things I do more instinctively that I don't even know that I'm doing, because I want to see either that person do well, or I see something in them that I'd like to get out. But I think some of the things I've probably done more intentionally as I get older, I've just noticed, hey, I've been successful at this. It may be natural, but let me repeat that, which is number one, listening. I think it's a huge thing to just listen to players, listen to now, similar to what you're doing on this. I mean, the media side of things and podcasting side of things, just listening. I mean, people will tell you a lot of what's going on in their heart, in their mind, in their spirit, based on just asking a few questions, and then you get out of the way and listen. And I think that's where, you know, some of my best work happens, because then my feel can come out and then I can understand them better. And instead of leading them like a player, or my daughters, for that matter, or my wife, from my own vantage point. I live in a house with four women, so a lot of listening is important, and it's paid off. So, but in order for me not to lead just from what I think should be happening to what they're actually expressing in their heart and in their mind and in their situation, and then taking that and saying, okay, well, how can I fit where I would like to get them to go here? And I think, so for example, I'm doing some things now, even where we're training coaches and training, you know, some youth league organization leaders, and doing some different consulting things. And I think one thing we talk about a lot is, you know, if you're developing leaders in your program, or if you want to lead young people, instead of just saying, well, you know, when we need you to buy into the team, or hey, you're not being your best today, or we need you to play better, or whatever the case may be, you know, finding out what they want to get out of that experience and what their goals are and holding them to that is so much more powerful. And sometimes you have to do a combination of both, right? It's not always just a straight line, but knowing that that kid wants to be an all-conference player is really important to help you motivate them towards their own ambition, instead of, you know, hey, coach is saying you need to be doing this. Well, he just may not be feeling that conversation. He may be tuned out because he's not motivated by what coach thinks, right? But coach is expecting you to get through to this kid. So then you spin it and say, hey, I know you want to be an all-conference player. Today, practicing like this doesn't help you do that. So how can we get you back on track to be, you know what I mean? It's like using their own words and their own motivation not necessarily against them, but to motivate them. So I think listening has been a huge one. And I think, you know, just investing the time, you can't really get out of some, you get out of things what you put in. And if you want to be great with players or have great player relationships or have great relationships, period, it just, it takes time. If you don't put the time in, it's hard to be able to get any good at it. So I think that's probably the last one, or the second one, and then the last one would be, you got to still have fun. It can't just be all business. They can't just only see the coach side of you. You have to try to connect on some other things that are not just that, so you can still have fun within all of it, and you can still celebrate and, you know, be able to not be so serious all the time. That's what I would say.
What's that look like off the court as a college assistant? Are you meeting guys for meals? Are you having them stop by the office in between classes? What does it look like off the floor when you're making that investment in time and making things fun? Because obviously there's a time when you're in practice that you got to go to work and you got to do the things that you need to do in order to be successful. So I'm thinking more just off the court stuff. What were some things that you did or times when you hooked up with guys just to let them know that, hey, I'm out here more than just as your basketball coach, but I'm out here as a guy that really cares about you as a person?
Yeah, I think so some cool things I can think about on top of my head. So it's players struggling, right? You usually get in the gym, you talk, you do all these things. You know, one time we just watched like his highlights from high school. Like, hey, I'm going to come by the room, I got something I want to show you. And then we just pulled it up on a laptop, talked about it.
That's cool.
About it, but it got him feeling good again. It got him remembering. And I just started asking questions. You know, hey, what? Tell me about this game. Who are you playing against? What was this? What was that? Oh, yeah, remember? And it just gets them kind of reliving that a little bit, and it just sparks that. So that was one. When we lived in El Paso, twofold in El Paso, I used to cut guys' hair in the locker room. So that was probably a cool bonding experience because, you know, when you're in the barber chair,
yeah,
you're just kind
sure.
of relaxing, kicking back, and you're serving them, and maybe they paid 50 cents, so it's not an extra benefit, right? And so they can't come back and get me in case they hear this.
But, there you go.
So that was one. You know, another one is just going in the locker room. They used to do some silly stuff there and just hanging out when they did their thing, not trying to coach them, not trying to be, you know, and maybe they're dancing, so maybe you jump in and you do something silly with a dance. I think that stuff is always fun. And then I'm trying to think some other ones. My wife and I, on Sundays in summer school, we had the guys over our house every Sunday for probably 5 weeks. You know, we'd get them over, cook a meal, hang out, watch either a comedy or some NBA summer league or whatever it was. And they could come and go as they please, but it was just kind of one of those things, hey, we're having food at this time. And, you know, breaking bread, they always love that, you know, a meal. And then obviously kids are on scholarship. They have all these different meals that they can have. So sometimes meeting them in the calf, I think, is always cool. I think sometimes going by their room, meeting them in their territory. Try to be creative with all those kind of different things, right? And I think, you know, sometimes even celebrating. So I think one thing I think I picked up that I became good at was staying really tied into the circle back home that you recruited them with, right? You'd recruit all these six or seven people, but then once they get there, and I learned it from one of my own OGs, but and he didn't do it. He did it more for problems. He was really good at, like, when things were smaller problems, he would still communicate them, and I was not good at that. But I started doing the, you know, the small things like that too, but also the celebrations. Hey, such and such did a great job on his test today. He may not tell you, but I want to tell you ahead of time so when you talk to him, you can bring it up. And it's just, it's kind of one of those things that was cool. Yeah, it ended up being cool because they were getting celebrated on that side. And, you know, they have the pressure, and they're trying to be their best self too. They got a lot going on, and you're juggling. College is hard. People that tell you differently is, I mean, they're juggling strength conditioning and study hall,
no doubt.
And, you know, classes, social, skill development, extra work, you know, film. So you got so many different things pulling at you, and you want to be the player that everyone thought you could be and the player you were in high school and all that stuff. So to be able to get celebrated for some of those other things, even if it was a great practice, you know, stuff like that, just try to have some fun with or try to video them when they didn't know we were videoing them, and then come back and say, you know, we're watching film, and pull up something of them, you know, doing something that makes them laugh. Just try to make it not so serious all the time. You know, there's so much business that goes on, and the head coach is normally the iron fist. I think those things, I found a lot of, you know, success in. And now, you know, the social media aspect of things, I did some of that. Some places are more comfortable with that than others. When I was still coaching, social media was still kind of trending upward. It wasn't where it is now. But, I mean, social media is definitely a cool way within your athletic department and within your own personal social media to be able to celebrate your guys in some positive ways, because that's the world that they exist in, you know what I mean? And even if it's not in a quote-unquote post and it's on your story, you know, and you tag them in it and then they can share it or whatever, I think just being able to have some fun and celebrate them, but also, you know, invest in the time in them.
There's so many good things that you can do with social media, and obviously there's some clear downsides to it as well. But I think when you look around the social media landscape, you can see that there's lots of coaches and programs that have embraced it, that are doing a lot of cool stuff, that, as you said, are able to recognize and celebrate the accomplishments of their program and their players. And to me, that makes a ton of sense, because we oftentimes hear the negative, right? Yep. You hear the negative stories of things that happen and somehow gets out there. And so we have this perception in a lot of ways that social media can be bad for athletics. And there certainly is that downside, but I do think that if you do it right and you understand it and you help your athletes to understand it, that there's a tremendous amount of benefit that can come from it, because you can put out those small celebrations like you just talked about.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, you look at the culture now. Think about this, and when I coached, and I don't want to sound like I'm a dinosaur, because it wasn't but 2 years ago I was just in it, but I say that, but coming up those 15 years, you know, it's changed a lot. There was no social media when we first started, and so many things have changed, but you didn't celebrate in the locker room with your team and have a water celebration or a dousing of the coach or anything like that unless it was a championship. And now – it's the exhibition game. It's the inter-squad scrimmage. It doesn't matter. You're just finding a way to celebrate it and record it and let everyone see that you're celebrating your wins. And I think that's one of the best things about the culture of basketball now and celebrating wins in college basketball is people are celebrating. And it used to be offensive, or they did this, they can't believe they tried to show us up. But now it's so commonplace. You just know if you lost to somebody, they're probably celebrating in the locker room, and it's probably going to be recorded and it may be seen, you know. It's just part of it, and it's not a negative on that sense, but more of a positive that guys get to celebrate with their coach. Coaches are dancing in locker rooms. People are getting to experience those kind of moments and celebrate wins, because it is really, really hard to win one game in college basketball if you know anything about it, because both teams have full scholarships or whatever scholarships or whatever recruiting that they've done to get their team. Both teams had a scouting report, more or less. Both teams had a game plan. Both teams have coaches that are getting paid for this, for their profession. You know, you keep going down the line. It's like it's a lot harder than what people think to win one game. So, yeah, I think social media is a great way to be able to celebrate some of those things. And the culture of basketball is changing to where there's more celebration going on than just the negative.
And you talked a little about interjecting some fun, right?
Right.
And trying to win games, like you just said, is difficult. And getting through a practice, getting through a season for a coaching staff, for players, it's not always that fun. It's always like, hey, we gotta get to work. And there's for sure that work aspect to it. So if you can interject some fun, whether it's just in the locker room with a quick little celebration and a video, and of course the kids today, unlike my generation, I'm still not used to, hey, I'm filming every single thing that I do.
Right.
But the kids today, that's just the way it is. They're used to something happens and I'm pulling out the phone and I'm recording it. So to be able to kind of jump down to their level, to get on that level with them, to be able to celebrate those small victories or those big victories, to me is really something that if you can do that, you're just interjecting a little bit of fun, a little bit of, hey, we just accomplished something. And I think sometimes that can get lost, and it's really important if you can do that.
Yeah, I think it goes back to that connection I was talking about, right? It's like that's an X factor thing. Yep. That everyone doesn't feel comfortable celebrating those things. Everyone doesn't do it. It's still not a everyone does thing, but it's way more commonplace. However, it does connect you to your players. We won this together. We put in this together. And there's so much adversity that happens in the season, whether it's injuries or losing streaks or whatever it may be in the psyche of a team is, you know, you look at these playoff series, it's like, okay, this team won at home. Now they go on the road, they lose two. What's going to happen in game five? It's like, where's the site? You know, all this stuff is, everything is so fragile. So anyway, to say that, to be able to connect with your players in that type of way, I think it just helps the bond grow closer that, you know, that those guys are, that you're with them and then everyone's in it together.
Absolutely. All right, let's jump to some of the things that you're doing now since you've got out of coaching. You're working with Rising Coaches. You got your All Access Network. Tell us, start with whichever one you want to start with and just tell us a little bit about sort of your semi-post-career activities that you got going on right now.
Yeah, so kind of I'd say if I had to point to someone who kind of gave me a little bit of a model and a blueprint that I didn't know what it was or didn't know that I was even following this, but it just was very inspired and moved by is the late and great legendary Kobe Bryant, right? So Kobe post basketball playing career was just involved in so many things that he was passionate about and that he could help other people. And he was involved in the game in a lot of different ways. So I think probably just taking a little bit of inspiration from there. Some of it was complete, you know, accident / God's divine providence or divine design, whatever you want to say. And just kind of ended up doing a lot of different things now. Basically, I guess the way I would sum it up is almost touching almost every aspect of the game that's not the actual college coaching part, right? From media to the Rising Coaches and the development stuff to All Access and that part of the media. So broadcasting games now this last year, did almost 30 games, which was an amazing experience to be able to be at that level, Division One, you know, and then there's some, you know, sports management side of things, which kind of my wife and I started a company. She's a volleyball coach, as I mentioned. I'm a former, you know, college basketball coach. So just trying to figure out how can we still use those same, you know, skill sets and experience and help others with it. So from events to consulting to development, it's just kind of grown. So we did a Rising Coaches Classic last year that so I have a position with Rising Coaches, the vice president of DEI Alliance. That kind of came about, long story short. I didn't know anything about Rising Coaches. And during the pandemic, everybody's at home. And we were doing some Zooms. And quite honestly, at that point in my life, like, I was trying to hide from anything social because I felt like the narratives was almost like, I don't know, the narrative sometimes in college basketball, you just want to play things safe, right? You don't know what's supposedly being said or what's not, or, you know, I was in a position where I was, you know, just trying to kind of lay low and not be misperceived like somebody's thinking like, hey, look at me, and particularly the boss that I worked for at the time. I thought he struggled with that, right? So I'm trying to be respectful to him and also not be misperceived. So I started doing some Zooms off the grid, text message advertisement, and I mean, it grew. It was me and another buddy of mine that I coached with who just wanted to do some stuff for, quite honestly, started with minority coaches to show that, hey, we're more than just guys that go recruit. Like, let's get a chance to show that we can coach and let other people that may not know or may just be interested in growing as a coach. So it started that way, and then it led to, you know, just anybody getting on that made sense. And I went from four people the first time to all the way to where you had to have a waiting room because there was more than 100 people on. And then so Rising Coaches, one guy kind of recommended me to go on there, and they have a big platform, they're doing some things. So I did, and it was fun, and then it kind of led to doing some social justice roundtables because of the time when George Floyd and all that was going on and felt like wanted to make an impact, right? So that started, and then that led to kind of being in this DI position. So that's been really cool. But the event that we put on our first MTE, my wife and I, with this company, and Rising Coaches, because of our relationship with the DEI Alliance, they decided to invest and buy the naming rights. So they actually had nothing to do with putting the event together. And then they jumped on and was like, hey, we want to do the naming rights. So that helped promote it and helped make it even bigger. So that was a cool experience. I never thought I would be hosting a Division I tournament. We had four teams in it. It was at College of Charleston. It was really, really cool thing. And then so we're doing some stuff with youth now, with basketball, doing some consulting, like I said, kind of helping some coaches develop, helping players and parents understand the recruiting navigation stuff, just education and do's and don'ts. So being able to be a source there, work with a few different camps as well. And then, yeah, so that's kind of that part. And then being able to consult as well with, you know, different coaches in the business, whether it's interview training. We did a thing with Rising Coaches DEI where we had a Next Up initiative, which was for minority. It wasn't for only minority coaches, but our alliance is made up of kind of these social justice groups / equality groups / just diversity groups. So there's about 12 different groups of all different nationalities and male, female, whatever. And they got to nominate people within their organization to be in this Next Up. So there's there was 12 people 2 years in a row. We had a search firm come in, kind of did the simulation of what it's like to get a job and interview. And it was really powerful. The first year we had three people go on to be head coaches. Ben Johnson from Minnesota was a part of the program. Coach G, that's at Colgate on the women's side. And then Jason Hart, that was at USC, that's now in the G League. So really successful thing to be able to do. So kind of a professional development. So now my wife and I do some of that ourselves through Uprise, and kind of taking those same kind of principles and access that we got. And our first client was my wife's twin sister, who's now the head coach at UC Riverside. So yeah, just kind of touching all kind of different things, from sports management to media to the development side of things to just hanging out and trying to we do our All Access Network as a podcast. We've had over 25 million views in two seasons, which has been an incredible amount, an incredible number. And we've been able to have coaches all the way from women's basketball to junior college to Division III to NAI to high major that have come on, and just try to be a small version of 15 Minutes of Fame or ESPN for college basketball coaches, and really coaches period and people period, during the season, because it's like you get these great wins, but no one cares. And it feels like, again, kind of like going back to that celebration thing, taking a page from that, just allowing the coaches and some of the programs to be celebrated for, I mean, no one's really paying attention to, let's think St. Peter's is a great example. If it wasn't for the NCAA tournament, no one knows that St. Peter's has won championships since I've always been there. So, where does St. Peter's get a chance to sell their story during the year when they get a big win, and they just don't, you know? So I think that's kind of was the idea, just feeling like you're frustrated with media when I was a coach, because not very many media people have ever played and not very many college basketball media have ever coached. So the perspective that they have is just from a different lens that they don't necessarily understand that lens. And the cool part about how we've done it with the network is aligning with other media members so that we can kind of infiltrate and overlap and coexist with them. And so now hopefully we can change some of their perspective, and their reach can help our reach. And now they get to interview some of these coaches with us. And it's, so they get to know them and they get to get a different perspective. And so it's been really cool so far. Great feedback, and just who knows what all is next. I think you asked that before we got on. I mean, I think the cool part about it is it kind of has taken a life of its own. There's definitely some things you have to say no to. We do some stuff in the scouting space as far as, you know, the portal and high school and JUCO. And, you know, I've been approached by two different entities to do scouting for them in a national scouting kind of position or role. But, you know, we've been blessed. You get to say no to some things that come along and some things you say yes to. And I think now it's just kind of figuring out what is the sweet spot of things to keep growing and what things you kind of think are maybe situational and you kind of leave those alone. But ultimately just want to help as many people, want to lead the nation in assists as best we can, as many years as we can, you know, and help as many people yep. from parents to coaches to families to, you know, programs, you name it. We just want to try to figure out how we can help and do some good and give back to the game that's done so much, and then also just shine some light on, you know, some of the other – there's so many great people doing great things in this game. It's hard for all of them to get the spotlight, but, you know, with ESPN and major networks, they're usually going to only cater to who they think they can – you know, who are the biggest names and who they can make the most money off of because they're spotlighting them. So what about everybody else? So that's kind of been the mission. And our youngest daughter, we found out 11 weeks into pregnancy, had a high chance to have special needs. And so part of our company, the concept of it is Uprise, that's the name. And the concept or the slogan motto is to rise above limitations. So I think we want to, you know, knowing that we have a young person that does have special needs, the best thing that could have happened to our family for sure, and just helps us have a different light that we kind of carry as we go through life, because we know it's way bigger than just a ball. But, you know, you also have an opportunity to help people believe bigger and achieve bigger, and kind of that same things we've been talking about, impact. It starts within our home, and she's impacting us every day, and I think that helps us have a different motivation to just go against maybe the odds or the naysayers, or, hey, you're a college coach, what are you doing now? And you shouldn't be doing this. And why are you doing that? You need to stay in one lane. It's like, you know, just kind of just figuring out how to help more people and not think with limits.
And you get to do that through the game of basketball. I think that's one of the things that is truly special, is you get to do something that you love and you get to use it to be able to have an impact, as you said, to be able to impact coaches, to be able to impact parents, to be able to impact players. I think that's one of the things that when I look at the basketball landscape, I think the ability to educate all those different groups about what's really happening and what, and to shine a light on some of the stories that, as you said, are maybe lesser known. I feel like that's one of the things that we've gotten a tremendous amount of satisfaction on with our pod, is just the opportunity to be able to talk to coaches at all different levels. I've often said that when you talk to somebody, let's say you're interviewing a high major Division I coach, and those coaches oftentimes have had an opportunity before to tell their story. Maybe they've had a big feature article in a magazine, or maybe they've had ESPN come and film and do all these things, and people have a really good understanding of kind of what their backstory is and where they've been. And yet you go and you interview a high school coach, that high school coach has probably never had a chance to tell their backstory and to kind of go through it and think about what they're all, you know, what they've done and how they've gotten to where they are. And to me, that's always been one of the most fun parts of what we do, is just the opportunity to hear these stories of different coaches and how they've started out, going back again, when we go back to their childhood and, okay, what were you like as a player? And when did you want to become a coach? And how did you end up as a high school coach and not a college coach? Or how'd you end up as a college coach and not a high school coach? And just hearing those journeys and giving light to people who have had success at all different levels of the game, that's really been fun. I think you're trying to do that same exact thing, is to be able to give those people a platform to be able to share, because there's tremendous amount of value that coaches at all level can provide. And that's, I think, really exciting. When you think about your behind the microphone, behind the camera experiences, how long did it take you, or when did you feel like you kind of had a handle on it? Because I know we always talk about my partner Jason, who's not on with us tonight, but he's on baby duty. He has his fourth baby. Nice. So he's been a little bit hit or miss here in the last couple of weeks. He's been a little hit or miss with helping his wife to make sure the baby's sleeping and all that good stuff. But anyway, he and I, exactly, no question about that. But he and I have talked a lot about thinking back to the beginning of this podcast and how bad we sounded and how sort of uncomfortable you were with that mic in front of you. And we talked about earlier about trying to grow and improve. So just how long did it take you before you felt like at least semi-comfortable behind the mic doing interviews? And then when you think about broadcasting games, just talk about your experience behind the microphone.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that. I think kind of going backwards just a little bit, the part that I love too about what we've set out to do with All Access is to target more assistant coaches as well. Because what happens in a program is program gets a big win, head coach gets to talk to the media, but the assistant coach is kind of in the background. So from being that guy that's in the background and knowing it's so hard to self-promote yourself because then it looks bad and you don't really want to do it anyway, but you do want to get the reps to do it if you have an opportunity, just working to provide more opportunities for coaches to get the reps to be comfortable so they can feel more confident to do it. So so kind of taking it, go back to what you said. Yeah, I don't know. That's such a good question. Some of it is such a blur for me. So we were in the pandemic and you're just going. I can remember doing it. We used to call it talking hoops. When we were doing that with a buddy of mine, and I said we went from 4 to over 100, and that was a fun ride. I could remember doing it with him, and he's a former head coach, and he had so much more comfort to do a lot of aspects when I was still kind of trying to hide, right? So I'm still kind of trying to hide and fall back, and you know, I'm kind of the one that was marketing to get everyone there. But then when I got there, it was almost like I wanted to hurry up and say my part and get out of the way. And it was almost like, and I think quite honestly, to be transparent, I think for me, I was hiding behind asking questions for a long time. Because you can ask a question and get out of the way, and you can even now with technology, you can take yourself off the screen, you're not even there. Like, I was doing a lot of that at first because you know, I think some of it was just trying to not make it about me, but the other part was not being as comfortable. So I think when it started to be more comfortable was the first time that I had to get interviewed. And I remember before I did it, I was literally asking a friend of mine, like, man, am I okay to do this? Because it was almost like on a pretty known radio situation. And it was like, well, if I'm going to go back to college, like, people may judge this and think, like, he shouldn't be doing that. He cares too much about his own whatever to be. So I had to ask that question, like, man, am I messing up something by doing this? And they gave me great advice. And it was like, hey, you know, sometimes it's bigger than thinking about all that other stuff later. And if you have that opportunity now and you kind of feel like God is, he may be doing something totally different than what you even know. And that guy was right. He was. So that was the kind of start of it. I think the first time I went on Chop Shop Radio with Jim Hicks and Robert Hatter in Houston, it started there, got more comfortable after speaking. And then the next thing you know, somebody says, like, never forget it. A buddy of mine was like, sent me a text and he said, "This is your lane," in all caps, exclamation points. And I'm like, what is he talking about?
That's cool.
I don't even know what this lane is, you know? Like, what does that mean? So had those moments. I think I was just, you know, for a long time, just, it's a challenge. I don't know if you've ever coached in college. I don't know your full story, but leaving the college basketball, it's almost like people think, like, what's wrong with him? Or what's wrong with that person, right? Like, well, how could you do that? Like, you kind of have to, it's a drug, you know? It's like people almost think, like, well, surely you want to get back in, right? Like, you're not just
right. There's so many people that want to get in.
No question.
That it's hard to imagine that somebody would want to get out
and stay out and actually be
right.
Be
right.
Content with it, like to know that they don't want to. So I think that part for me was, it's such a mental shift, because when you're in that lane as a college coach, you're so all in, you're so immersed, and that's all I knew for the most part for the greater part of 16, 17 years, almost 20 years. So you're like, it's just hard to reprogram your brain, right? And you're so anyway, it took a while, I would say. I think when I got interviewed, and the more I got interviewed, the more I started being comfortable, because I couldn't just ask a question and get out of the way, right? I couldn't just spotlight somebody else and then chime in some and then get out of the way. So, because I actually had to have my own answers. So I think that's when it started. And then, yeah, the broadcasting, my first time doing it, I volunteered to do it with my brother. My brother's a women's basketball head coach at Texas A&M Commerce. They're now going to the Southland Conference. They were number one in the country last year for the first time in program history. So he's done a lot of great things. He's the all-time winningest head coach there, so on and so forth. Well, I went during Christmas break. We're at home for Christmas, and I just tried to volunteer because I was asking everybody during the pandemic. But it was a weird time. People didn't want people in gyms, and they didn't want extra media people on. So you're just – it's kind of like being a player that wants to get on a team, but you have no film. It's like, well, why would we put you on your team? Well, you don't have any film. You've never played. So it was tricky to get reps doing it. But from the first time, I put a lot of prep into it because I wanted it to go well and probably put – I mean, it's crazy it sounds. Maybe for – I had four games in a row, so two on Saturday, two on Sunday, doubleheaders, men and women. And I want to say it was 6 to 8 hours of prep from watching to stats to phone conversations to going through every roster, talking to the assistant, head coach, just really wanted to kind of know what I was getting into. And so – I would say the first time I felt really comfortable the first time, and a buddy of mine who works now works in the for Sports Illustrated, he kind of said to me, he's like, you know, it's pretty natural for you. A lot of people don't have the same. It's so different than podcasting because there's kind of a rhythm and a timing and a, you know, pace to it. And so I think initially I was very comfortable. And then it's funny because then when I did my first ESPN Plus game this year, I was so uncomfortable because you just know, like, you want it to go well. You don't know how you're sounding. Right. I think I was speaking so low. Like, I was just like, I don't know, very in my own head. It's just natural sometimes. You want to do so well. And I did prep well, but I don't know. I was nervous. I was doing it with somebody else. And again, you're just like, wanting to make sure it goes well. So a little bit nervous on that one. Didn't know kind of my rhythm with this particular guy, wanted to do it right. He had way more experience than I did. May have been a little bit intimidated, but just wanted to make sure I didn't do a bad job, right? So they're like, hey, you don't need to come back, you know? So it worked out. We only had one game in November, and then we had a lot of time off, and just found myself watching more college basketball and then kind of getting the feel of some of the nuances. I didn't go to school for this. And the other games I did were on – they were technically radio, which means the play-by-play guy is talking a lot more and the color analyst just kind of jumps in. Where on television, it's not necessarily the opposite, but it's more about the analyst.
Balance, more balance.
More balance, yeah, and more balanced. A little more led by the analyst than it is the play-by-play even. So that's the part where I was very uncomfortable too because it was a shift. And so anyway, I watched more games and – talked to the guy I was working with and got some more chemistry. And yeah, from then on, just started having fun with it. Probably started to stop making it so serious, but continue to do the prep work because that makes you feel confident. And then, next thing you know, you look up and you're calling games in the Mountain West. I called my first game there and was, again, really nervous because the production level was even more. You're doing pre-recorded entries. You're on more video with your whatever you're wearing, and there's so many people talking in your ear. It's like, wait a minute, like I'm distracted. Like, stop talking to me. Are you talking to me? Absolutely. Or are you talking to somebody else? So I think that was a whole thing to learn. But ultimately, I don't know that I ever got to where I thought I was necessarily great at it, but I felt like I was comfortable to just call what you see and don't think about who's watching, who may be watching, how does it sound. Just call what you see, do a good job in the game, and I got to call some really cool games. I mean, Wyoming had an amazing year. Unexpectedly, they were top 25. Boise State, I got to call them. They were a team that won both championships in the Mountain West. I got to do a lot of cool stuff, which was great. A lot of overtime games. I got a game where the coach got kicked out the first 5 minutes of the game. So that was a big deal. I got another one where it was like a, I don't know, I think a team came back from like 27 in the last 6 minutes of the game or something insane. Or so, yeah, I had some crazy comebacks and crazy games to call and some adverse moments. So I think that was probably my proudest moment of it all, was that when it was probably the hardest and the most unpredictable moments, I think I was able to kind of settle in and not let my own emotions lead me to, you know, just reacting and just being able to take a step back and do a good enough job to still be on the call. And I got a couple cool compliments from, you know, some high-level head coaches after one of the game. One was the game I was calling and the coach that got kicked out. The other one was an NCAA tournament-level coach that was watching the game, and him and his wife reached out, and I was so shocked to hear it from them and thinking, you know, hey, you may have something here. You may be, you know, this is really natural for you and blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, is this really happening? Like, I felt like I was, you know, I felt like I was like trying not to mess up. And if you knew only what I was feeling, right. But I think that's the cool part about it is like when people can give you encouragement, who knows where it goes. I'm having fun with it. I definitely love to do it, and we'll see where it goes. But I think for both of them, I don't know that there's a point of like true arrival, but I do feel like there's some
right
cool moments of people recognizing what you're doing. And, you know, I think the less you think about, and you said it best, I mean, it's really more about being comfortable than it is thinking that you're good at it. You know, I don't know that I'm good at it.
I agree
not,
with that.
You know, but I think it's just more of, I feel like I found my own niche to do it my own way, and people that like it, great. We appreciate it. And people that don't, no big deal. We're going to keep going anyway.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to say it. I think you have to almost forget that the microphone's there and almost forget that a bunch of people are listening to you. And instead, what you have to do is just allow your own personality to come through.
Right.
And either people like you or they don't. Like, one of the things that we were most surprised about with the podcast, honestly, Brian, is we thought, hey, if we can get guest X, who's going to be a big name, that people are going to come on and they're going to listen to that episode, and that's really going to help us grow our audience. And that helps maybe to some degree. But the reality is that when people listen to our podcast, they only listen more than one time if they like the host.
Right.
And if they don't like the host, right, it doesn't matter who the guest is. They're like, God, I don't want to listen to Mike anymore. Right. That guy is atrocious. And they're going to go somewhere else. And so I think ultimately what you have to do is you have to kind of forget that the microphone's there. And once you can do that and you can just talk and be yourself and have your own personality come out, as you said, you try to grow just like you do as a coach, just like you do as a player. You try to grow and improve and self-critique and all the things that we talked about earlier. And you hope that over the course of time that you get better at it. But ultimately what you're trying to do is make it seem like you're just having a conversation, that it's not something that you're doing behind the microphone. For you, you're just talking basketball and you're showing and trying to help the viewer to better understand what they're seeing in the game. And in a podcasting realm, when you're interviewing somebody, you're trying to give them the platform to be able to share their story. And your questions, you're just kind of guiding them along to hopefully help them to be able to share their knowledge with your audience. And that's ultimately what we try to do. And I think it's just something that for us, I know, has been a lot of fun, because you see your own growth, you see your own improvement. And then as a result of that, I think hopefully you're able to provide value to your audience, whatever that audience may be.
Yeah. I think the part, I mean, you guys are, I say you guys, you are very natural at this. You can tell you've done it a lot. You can tell you're kind of have, I don't want to say perfected your craft, but you've worked on your craft. You can tell, for sure. There's an element of when you're comfortable as a host and you can establish a certain level of comfort, it definitely helps your guests to be more comfortable to just be themselves. And when you can kind of build that rapport, right? I mean, we've talked only about this podcast, but it's easier. And I think most people have been on, more or less, have been on multiple interviews of some kind, maybe not multiple podcasts, but. And you hear like some of the horror stories of some of like, yeah, I just didn't, like, they just kept talking and I didn't get to talk, or they just kept, you know, there's always different things, right, that happen. And I think it's natural for you in the space that you're in. You guys have obviously had some great amount of reps and have built a great reputation. But I do think the cool part about it's kind of like being a head coach. Like, some people think you should be doing it this way. Some people think you should be doing it that way. But, you know, you're going to build the people that like the way that you coach or want to support your program just based on being you and not somebody else. And, yes, you're going to grow and evolve. But, you know, the more you can be yourself, I think that's the thing. And for me, I think the fun part has been, you know, just such a point guard in how I think. So I'm always kind of thinking, you know, problem solving or helping somebody be their best or look their best. So, you know, podcasting and then doing the broadcasting, you know, the broadcasting is really almost a, it's definitely an art form. It's definitely a skill. There's a lot of nuances. And I had a buddy that was, you know, very academic about it. And he went to school for journalism and all that. He's kind of watching the game and he's telling me these notes. And I'm like, trying to keep up. And then one day he watched one of the games in overtime. He's like, ultimately, whether you're doing all those things or not, it's entertaining when you're doing your games. So just keep doing what you're doing. You know, he's like, ultimately, that's what people are going to, they're not going to care if you're checking every box and doing every technical aspect. They can teach you that stuff. But what you're doing is your passion for the game comes out. So you have to keep doing that part. And I think there's such a part. So kind of how I got motivated to do this broadcasting a little bit was, there's so many guys that just did a bad job when we had games. And it's like, you've never talked to us. You never came to a practice, never came to a shoot around, but yet you're telling whoever's watching this broadcast who we are and what we're doing, and you don't even know. So I felt like it's just a way that you put so much into it, and knowing as a coach how much we put into our craft to win a game and to build a program and to recruit good players and all of these things. And for somebody to get on a microphone and not honor that, I just felt like it's so disrespectful to the game. And I think more than anything, like, I just put more into it because I want to respect the game and respect the coaches that are coaching and the players that are playing and the people that are watching, to give them the best representation of whatever they would want to get out of this. Not because I think I know the answers or because, you know what I mean? It's more so about just diving into this and being the expert of these two programs and this matchup and these moments, and then having some fun with it and obviously giving the proper shout outs when they're needed or whatever. But I just think it's just such a way to honor the game. So that's probably the part where I'm more conscious of doing what I hated people to do. I hate's a strong word, but I just really strongly dislike them to do when we were going. And then I also just want to just honor the game, man, and just give the respect when it's due. And, you know, sometimes you are hired by a home team. It's not a CBS or Fox broadcast, so to speak, or ESPN. Sometimes you're hired by a home team and you don't want to be the home broadcast that's also overly biased, that makes other people want to push mute because they're, you know, only going to hear about the home team. You know, it's like everything the home team does, oh, that should have been a block. Well, then that should have been a charge. And I can't believe this is happening. That ref would call that, you know? So anyway, I think that's probably more the motivation for me in it. And, you know, that part has been fun. And I think the coaches have respected that part of it too, which hopefully helps for, you know, further opportunities if so fit. If not, I'm great doing just what we're done to this point, because, you know, I've been able to do some NCAA tournament games, Division II, did a WNIT game this year. So, I mean, I'm still learning what I'm even doing, and I didn't have the quote-unquote highlight film that you send out to show people what you do. It's just literally asking, beg, borrow, and plead, and, hey, I'll do it for free. Just let me do it, and next thing you know, like, it kind of takes a life of its own.
Giving back to the game, putting all that time in and preparing and trying to do a great job because it's important to you because of the respect that you have for the game of basketball and what it's done for you. And I think that's something that we've tried to do 100% is to make sure that we've been true to what we believe, true to the game of basketball, and try to give people an opportunity, a platform to be able to share. We have blown past an hour and a half, Brian. I want to give you a chance before we wrap up. Share how people can find out about all the different things you're doing, how they can connect with you, whether you want to share website, social media, email, whatever you'd like to share that people can use to find out more about what you're doing. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. So first and foremost, thanks so much for having me on, taking the time, making the time. I know sometimes it's difficult with rescheduling and scheduling and whatever may come up. And I just appreciate the, you know, the professionalism and the, you know, making me feel comfortable to still do it and not feel bad. Like, man, is this the wrong time? It's the right time. So you've been awesome. I appreciate that. I think that's
it's all good, man. We appreciate you, man. We don't take our guests lightly. We don't take their time lightly. So like it. It's been great, man.
So for me, email, the easiest email is coach, COACH, Burton, BURTON 13 at Gmail. Social handle for Twitter and IG is at Coach Burton 13. Pretty simple. Most of everything else you can find there, probably the easiest way. And then website-wise, I think the only one we have up and running so far, we just got it up and running, is the Uprise Sports Management. Uprise Athletics Group, which is our sports management firm, and that is www.upriseag.com. So, yeah, that's the best ways to find me, and usually it'll lead down more rabbit holes. You'll find other things from me.
Absolutely. Brian, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. Appreciate, just as you said, you appreciated us making it work. We appreciate you making it work. And it's been a lot of fun getting to know you, getting to know a little bit about what you've done in the game of basketball, both as a coach and now in this sort of after coaching life that you've gotten started. A lot of exciting projects and things going. And I'm sure there's going to be more things on the horizon. So again, thank you. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.